McMorrow stays with it at the end wall. McMorrow out of the corner. Got the shot. Scores! Fine individual play. Brendan McMorrow.
You're listening to All the Kings Men, the official podcast of the LA Kings.
And welcome back inside Prospero Place. Here's a chance. Sharp skates in.
Now, here's your host, Jesse Cohen.
Welcome back, Kings fans. I'm Jesse Cohen. This is All the Kings Men. Rookie camp begins this week. Then, this weekend, we have the Golden State rookie face-off in Irvine. And so we're combining the final two draft picks from the 2025 NHL entry draft into this one episode. I should say the final two draft picks for your LA Kings into this one episode. We'll be hearing about Brendan McMorrow and Will Sharp today. As usual, we've got Mark Yannetti and Scott Wheeler to talk about McMorrow and Sharp. And today, we've also got Brett Olson, head coach of the Waterloo Blackhawks, to talk about Brendan McMorrow. And as always, I sincerely hope you enjoy it.
All right, we're here to talk about Brendan McMorrow, taken 196th overall by the LA Kings in the 2025 NHL entry draft. Joining us now from the Waterloo Blackhawks, associate head coach Brett Olson. How are you doing today, Brett?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you. So we've already spoken to Mark Yannetti, the director of amateur scouting for the LA Kings. We've talked to Scott Wheeler from The Athletic. And when we start doing these projects, when we start evaluating these players taken in the draft, the first step I make is, and it's a real cheat on my part, but I just call up the Hockey Writers draft profile page. It's pre-formatted. It's got a bunch of information on it. And that's my starting point. And it'll have like a bunch of strengths, a bunch of weaknesses. Brendan McMorrow didn't have a prospect page, so I was sort of on the back foot. But talking to Mark, talking to Scott, what we heard about Brendan McMorrow was speed and motor. Does that sound like the player you're familiar with?
Those are definitely the strengths for Brendan, for sure. The guy can fly up the ice. He played in the middle for us last year, something that he had to get used to from a positional standpoint and learning how to be a true centerman. He just developed that part of his game even better. And learning to take faceoffs throughout the year, but what he does really well is he supports the puck up the middle of the ice, and if people get it into his hands, he comes up the ice with a lot of speed, with a full head of steam, and he doesn't stop until he's basically dead tired, needs to get his shift break when he comes back to the bench. So hit it spot on for sure.
He's got the profile of a kid where, you know, it's like, okay, he's a seventh round pick, he's an overager. It could be viewed as negatives, but if those types of players hit, it almost like amplifies their story. It almost makes them, you know, a better prospect because they've, you know, learned a lesson or fought through adversity or whatever you want to call it. So, you know, is the fact that Brendan McMorrow drafted, you know, when he's 19 in the seventh round, is that a strength for him or a weakness?
You know, it can go one of two ways, but I always think the more developed you are later in the process, it becomes more of a strength. There's a lot of time of development going through those stages as you get to the pro game. You know, young kids either tend to phase out or they'll develop even more and continue on that path. And, you know, the scouts trying to project those guys, it's a tough game to do with so many players out there these days. And you never really know. It's at the end of the day, it's up to the player on how they're going to really take their development process moving forward and how they can continue to project out. And I mean, just look at a guy that we had here, Joe Pavelski, a long time ago, who was a really late round pick of the San Jose Sharks, and that worked out pretty well for him. So, you know, just because you're a number one draft pick doesn't mean it's a guarantee. Just because you're a seventh round draft pick, you know, obviously things might look a little bit more uphill in that regard. But at the end of the day, there's still a lot of timeline of development that has to happen for all of those players before they reach the next step of the NHL.
We've talked to a handful of people already from the USHL, and like, full disclosure, I'm just not terribly familiar with the league. You know, I know some of the teams that players have been drafted from, and but I'm just, you know, I'm out here in Southern California and we just don't get a lot of exposure to a lot of junior hockey. And so I know the OHL, I know the Q, I know the W and everything. And, I'm aware of the USHL, but it sounds like it's a really underrated league in terms of difficulty and development.
Yeah, I think you hit it with the difficulty aspect. Out of all of those leagues, it's probably the hardest league to come across. It tended to be a little bit of a higher average age in our league. The league is a bit more defensive than a lot of the CHL leagues. So players really having to push and score points in this league, it's harder to put up as high of numbers. And we would argue that we have a much better depth structure as you get from top line to the bottom lines, moving through the depth charts of the lines too, that it makes a league a much harder league to play in across the board.
Talking about the defensive difficulty of the league, I'm looking at your team's roster last year. Brendan McMorrow, if I'm not mistaken, led your team in goals with 24. And I'm looking at the age distribution on your roster, and it's not like, you know, my first assumption was, well, yeah, of course, he probably led the team in scoring. He's probably older than everybody on the team. But I'm looking at the age distribution, and it doesn't look like he was, you know, he's not like the only 18-year-old on a team full of 15-year-olds. He's one of a bunch of guys you've got who are 17, 18, 19 years old, if not older.
Right, and that's why that structure of the league being a little bit more difficult is there are some older players. We do have a 20-year-old roster rule that you can only carry four of those players during the season. But as you get going forward, a lot of those guys that come to junior for that transition period, especially from this league being a major feeder up until the new rule change for the NCAA, you know, that allowed a little bit more older players to develop a lot longer in their careers in the USHL. And again, having that many more older players across the board just made it a bit more challenging of a league to play in for players, for sure.
So Brendan McMorrow has 24 goals in 58 games. It's his first season in the USHL and only 4 penalty minutes. I'm assuming that's a testament to the speed and being able to avoid, you know, dirty plays.
Yeah, his speed helps. It takes away the stick penalty aspect. When he can catch anybody or get, you know, a couple, 3-4 steps and he's already on somebody with those first quick steps and his ability to go at a high end speed up the ice, he doesn't have to take a lot of stick penalties where you draw a lot of those penalty minutes throughout the year. So, you know, he still has a physical game of learning how to get into the inside, but he's smart with how he makes body contact on the defensive side, not in dirty situations. And, you know, his work ethic and working hard to hound the puck is something that it keeps him out of trouble when he's using that speed and footwork ability to get pucks back.
And his name's been mentioned a lot recently when we're recording this in late July because of the summer, the WJC summer showcase. I always trip over that. What about him is the type of player that would be, I mean, I know he had experience in the USNTDP, but what's his strongest skill that gets him mentioned in those types of conversations in teams like that?
I think that that compete that he has, you talk about the motor, the compete within his mind is always going. He's probably his hardest critic, which is something that he's going to have to learn to not be so hard on himself and understand that game of hockey is a game of mistakes at times. But he's not going to take the foot off the gas on himself and just continue to try to get better in all aspects of the game, defensively away from the puck, offensively with his scoring and finishing ability and setting up plays, you know, things that he was working on this year. But just, you know, that speed aspect and the motor and the compete, like when you have a kid that intrinsically knows how to compete, those are the kids that really put themselves ahead and give themselves a step up against everybody else across the board.
I want to talk about what you just said about him being his own strongest critic, because I'm a huge Ted Lasso fan. And one of the, you know, quotable lines is he tells one of the players, be a goldfish, you know, the happiest animal on the planet, 10 second memory. And the message there is just, if something bad happens, just flush it. Don't worry about it. But I'm also a really strong believer in the idea that you can't solve a problem unless you acknowledge what it is. And so in order to do that, you have to be self-aware. You have to be able to criticize yourself and be honest and just say, okay, this mistake happened because of, you know, this, and so address it. So where is that line, and does he straddle it well between acknowledging problems, addressing them, but also not sort of losing any sleep over them and dwelling on them and spiraling out of control?
Yeah, that's something that part of this league that is kind of fun from the development aspect as well, or even the whole age group. I'm sure junior coaches can kind of talk about this when kids are not only working on the physical aspects of their game, but the mental side of their game as well. And so when you see a player develop their physical side, you know, part of that development process is the mental side too, because the pro hockey game is a grind. There's no question about that. And anybody that's been in it understands that, and the travel and everything that you have to put your body through throughout the course of the year to keep up and be successful and maintain roster positions and whatnot. But when the mental aspect, and with Brendan, when we talked about that earlier on, is we watched him grow not only physically as a player, but as a player mentally with regard to that, the goldfish mentality. And that's something, the concept that we'd kind of talked about, maybe not in those specific terms, like the Ted Lasso terms, but you know, the quick mindset, the resets on the bench. Can you, the next shift mentality, you know, where can you just get what matters now in that moment? And is it, you know, is it something that you should worry about? Is it going to be bothering you 5 seconds, 10 minutes from now? you know, a day from now, how important really is that situation, especially on the ice? It's all within the seconds. It's all within the minutes. So having that short turnaround and reset, reframe the mind to get back when something doesn't go your way, I think it's just important for all athletes in general to have to understand, especially in the game of hockey, because things happen so fast.
Reputations are funny things. And, you know, I've been working for the Kings for a while now, and I've been a fan even longer than that. And, you know, my instinct is to want to just love every prospect that the Kings acquire and to just be like, all right, well, there's future Hall of Famer right there. No problem. But, you know, doing these interviews and talking to coaches every summer of all the players we draft and acquire, and I've grown to sort of identify certain scouts in the organization and go like, if that guy likes somebody, I just believe in that kid automatically. Like, I just trust the person's track record. I trust that they know more than I do, and that if they see something, I'm on board for it. How long into the season did you start to get a sense that the Kings had their eye on Brendan McMorrow? Are you even aware of that sort of thing? Is it helpful to be aware of that sort of thing? Is it harmful to be aware of that sort of thing?
You know, we know there's a lot of scouts at all the games watching from the very beginning when we go to Pittsburgh for the start of our season. You know, every team plays two games there in front of all the scouts and everybody's brass if they're available to be there at that time. So we know guys are looking at players throughout the season continuously. They stop in our offices and they ask us. Now, as that gets closer to Christmas, when they start really starting to hone in on the guys on who they're looking to draft, they'll start to put out the draft questionnaires. And then that's when we'll know individually who is more interested in a specific player, what organizations are looking for the specific players. And that's when they come to talk to them and do the interviews in person and stuff. So then once that stuff happens, kind of, you know, post Christmas and then more towards March, that's kind of when we have the idea. So, you know, there were several teams talking to Brendan, several teams talking to some other guys in our teams, and we just help facilitate those communication aspects when they ask for those situations to meet the players and talk to them.
I won't ask you to name names, but are there some organizations where if they start sniffing around, you kind of hope that a player doesn't wind up there, or, you know, conversely, are there some organizations where if they start sniffing around, you start talking to the player and you go like, I really hope you wind up on this team? Just development paths, you know, depth charts, whatever it is, markets, you know, there's a million reasons that a fit might be a good fit or a bad fit for a player.
Yeah. You know, without getting that into too much, the biggest thing for us is worrying about our players moving on to the next level. And we talk about, obviously, the next route for most of these guys is college, but they're already drafted. They're already committed to colleges basically when they come to us anyway. So what our goal is to try to make them pro hockey players. And regardless of who wants to talk to the player at that point, if they're getting talked to by somebody, if they're getting interest from somebody, we consider that a success on our part from a development standpoint and the communication aspect. Now, when you talk to individual people and how people talk and communicate and go about things, now that's a whole different story. That is just an interaction for us dealing with people. But for the most part, everybody, when they're looking to try to talk to these guys, they're very cordial. The guys in most of the leagues, and especially the scouts, because they go out and they see the guys, they see people face to face, especially when they come to talk to us, they build a rapport, and it's a good situation to have when they're looking to come talk to guys. So
if I'm not mistaken, Brendan McMorrow was one of those players who's committed to play college hockey next year. So you get him for 1 year. What's going to be the hardest part to replace about Brendan McMorrow in the locker room, never mind on the ice?
His personality, honestly. He's quiet, and you got to wait till you kind of can peel the onion back a little bit, one layer at a time. And then once he lets the guard down a little bit and gets going, he's a really, you know, happy kid. He's a guy that wants to have fun, and he enjoys being around his teammates in the locker room. And it takes a serious side of coming to talk to us about video, but also, you know, kind of the family aspect and having discussions and more interest outside of the game of hockey, which is important for everybody's mental sake and the capacity to play the game. And he was one of the loudest guys out there, and whether good or bad, or if he could get, you know, poke the bear a little bit, I think the guys could get him going every once in a while, but it always turned into good fun with the guys. And it was always fun hearing those guys laughing and locking. He was always in the mix with it, so it was good.
As of the day we're recording, he's slated to go to the University of Denver. That's another one of those reputation things where you go, oh, Denver wants him? Like, okay. Like, if they trust him, I guess I believe in it. What's he going to bring to Denver? Like, we've talked about his motor, we've talked about his speed, his personality. Do you feel like he is a professional, like that the Waterloo Blackhawks have done their job and turned him into a professional hockey player?
I would hope so, but that's still yet to be determined. You know, there's always the next phase now where that goes on. We did what we thought was necessary to try to develop parts of his game that he was lacking while continuing to develop the games that he was already successful or proficient in. And, you know, Denver obviously having a great program and people with a great reputation for development, obviously in the college world, that's going to be a great place for him to go and continue on growing as a player. You know, and outside of the USHL thing for Brennan as a one-year thing, well, the NTDP plays half their games in the USHL anyway on the 18s and the 17s when he was going through. So he's basically had 3 years of experience in the USHL already, including ours last year. So we got him and he knew what the league was like and we were excited to have him. And that developmental process starting there, basically in the league with the NTDP and then to us, I think just does set him up for potential for a lot of success down the road.
Excellent. Well, Brad Olson, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And best of luck on the upcoming season out there in Waterloo.
Thank you. You guys as well.
All right, the next player we're going to talk about drafted in the seventh round, 196th overall, Brendan McMorrow. And I said earlier that the first move I make, Mark, when I try to start learning about guys, the first move I make is to just go to the Hockey Writers, pull up their draft profile because they just have a really convenient format. They have strengths, weaknesses, some quotes thrown in. It's just it's a good starting point. And McMorrow's the second player on the Kings draft list this year that just didn't have a profile on the Hockey Writers, which is fine. It just means I go to Elite Prospects next and I just start looking at different places. But it puts me at a disadvantage because that format is where I start, you know, it's just the foundation for my thought process on a player. So without that foundation, I'm sort of operating a bit in the blind. So what's the first thing I need to know about Brendan McMorrow?
Well, skating. Excellent speed. He's got moments where he can just separate from guys. His acceleration is good. Without the puck, he gets on you quick. Like he's one of those guys that just jumps on you without the puck, you know. And then with the puck, he's got that speed, but he's also got that kind of dynamic change of pace. Like he can put on the brakes, change directions. You know, his change of speed is pretty good. His game for me is built around the skating, and I would say pace-based compete or energy-based compete. Those would be the two. Those would be the two things that would stand out if you're watching him. That's what would stand out.
He strikes me as the kind of guy, based on what I've read and what I've heard of, does a lot of the things that a coach likes from a bottom six forward, like a good skater, but he also works, you know, alongside of it. Is that kind of what you see in him as well?
Absolutely. Coaches will, you know, as I said, coaches will instantly like this guy. As I said, his skating is excellent and he gets on pucks quickly. So this is a guy who brings energy. He's determined. You know, you use that game, 200-foot game. I think it's a cliche and I don't like it, but with him, he's responsible. He checks well, he defends well. He's always in, you know, in the scrums and the piles and the battles. He can create offense through quantity, through accumulation. He doesn't have the greatest touch or the greatest, you know, shot-based offense, but he's always around the puck. He's always digging. His speed allows him to get multiple chances. So he can create offense kind of through, just that accumulation of being there. But as a bottom roll guy, you know, so you'd like him to be a little bit bigger. He probably is a shade under 6 feet. That would be the only thing against him in terms of the bottom roll. I would rather fill it at 6'2", but every one of those attributes, and again, he's even physical, like he's hitting guys. He's, you know, I think one of our scouts, I think it might've been Teddy. It could have been Andy. Well, but it said, I think one of them said his motor never stops. So it's a really good compliment. And then as soon as I hear that, I can picture the player.
I feel like a couple of years ago, drafted an overage kid from the USHL, and Jared Wright said a lot of the same kinds of things. He went to Denver. He was never like a top line guy there, but had a nice path there. Now he's on a pro deal. He's playing in the AHL, on track to be kind of what it seemed like it was thought to be. Is that a confidence builder that there were some similarities there? You saw the path work. Now maybe you can run it back.
Yeah, as I said, When you're talking about a late pick, he's got the attributes that it takes to succeed. The biggest difference between him and the two biggest difference, one is Jared's big, he's 6'3". That's in Jared's favor. The one in this kid's favor is he's got some natural grit and meanness. He's a little bit more in your face. That will serve this kid well. But yeah, it's seeing the path work in Denver and seeing this kid go there. It certainly helps. It certainly gives you some more confidence. And as I said, coaches like this kid, which always helps.
There's no way Jared Wright is 6'3". I saw him standing next to Cohen Zimmer on the ice during dev camp. That kid is 6'5" if he's an inch. That kid is huge.
Oh, that's not, as I said, if he's 6'5", let me look and see what my scouting thing says.
That's like when they tell me that Hellenius is 6'6", and then I'm standing next to him and his head is in a different.
Maybe he's growing. I got him at 6'3". I hope he's 6'5". I'll be 6'6". Good.
Seeing him stand next to Cohen Zimmer, I was like, who is that? How do we have a player so short at dev camp? And then, you know, Wright turned around and I went, oh, he's standing next to Jared Wright. And then because Cohen Zimmer is not exactly small, but standing
next
to
Jared. No, he's not. He's 6 foot tall kid.
Yeah, but standing next to Jared Wright, he seemed very small.
Hey, I hope he's, as I said, I got him at 6'3", maybe. Maybe.
Talking about McMorrow as a seventh round pick, and you know, we're talking about Jared Wright. Over the last few years, the Kings have made late round picks that seemed to come with a certain level of excitement, whether it was Woolley or Reeder or Conmee or Wright or Lawrence or Yamson or Lee. I mean, I'm going back a little bit further than I want to, but like there have been late round picks that you guys have been excited about and expressed it even, you know, in the days following the draft. Is McMorrow in that same category? And the reason I ask is because, you know, it's now the eighth of nine guys you drafted. And just the conversation we have with Scott Wheeler is, you know, top of mind, where it's like teams don't draft, you know, don't rank 200 and however many picks there are, all those players. So drafted 196th overall, that it's just that question pops in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, take it in context. You know, I think it's 2.5%, 2.7% of seventh round picks play 200 games. Like, right. It's rare. So you take it in context. I can tell you this. 15, 17 drafts, whatever it is. The guys we've taken in the seventh round, I can count on one hand. I won't say the names because it's not fair. But I would say there's probably four guys that our guys weren't excited about. Very rarely is a seventh round pick on that. Very rarely do we draft a guy in the seventh round that would be numerically in the seventh round on our list. I don't think people understand how list rooks and how different NHL teams lists are. Like if you looked at the Boston Bruins list and then looked at the Philadelphia Flyers list, you know, after the first 10 or 15, maybe 20 players, you'd be like, you know, you're looking at something different. Like it's like, you know, it's like you're looking at a science book and a philosophy book. So there's a lot of different. So I can tell you there's an emotion that goes with some picks from the guys that know the areas the best. Going way back, and it could be any round. There's an emotion like Fuda. Fuda had an emotional response to Simmons. We all did, but Fuda had a really emotional response to Simmons. Gasparini had an emotional response to Alec Martinez. You know, again, we all did, but it was that guy that had it right off the bat that brought it to us that was driving the bus. And again, you can talk about Matt Roy. You could talk about Jordan Nolan. You could talk about some other, I mean, even in other rounds, like Voinoff with me, you know, early on in my career, it was just a guy that I had an emotional reaction to. I mean, that's a second round guy, but there's all these that happens with draft picks. So usually a guy that we take in the seventh round is a guy that there's some kind of an emotional reaction to. Take it in context. You know, we're realizing it's a later round pick, but if there's not an emotional reaction to the guy, we usually try to get out of the pick. Because to make it in the seventh round, you have to have something. You know, to make it in the fifth round, you have to have something. There has to have something that makes a scout want to draft you. I can tell you there have been a couple guys that we've drafted where we haven't been able to get out of the pick, and we're like, oh, we got to draft this guy. And very rarely does he succeed. He's the next guy on the list, but there's just not that, you know, that oomph, that impetus that makes guys, like, you know, there's all these horrible scouting cliches, like banging on the table for a guy. If anybody in our group banged on the table for a guy, we'd toss him out of the room. You know, well, no, if you have to bang on a table for a guy, you either haven't presented him well or you're wrong. So I hate those scouting cliches, but there are guys that our guys have emotional reactions to. At least one of our scouts did have an emotional reaction to McMorrow, Harrington, Rimpinen with Rutu, and Lombardi with one of our scouts. To varying degrees, they had an emotional reaction. Those were the guys. I could say Vucevic, but that's, you know, everybody has an emotional reaction to the guys you take in the first round because they're just better. But those guys had a, whether you want to call it a champion or whatever, they don't get on the list without everybody getting there. But and in every draft, there's at least one or two of those guys. They don't all make it either. Like, but those guys do have a history of overperforming for us.
Next pick we're talking about, taken in the sixth round, 196th overall, Brendan McMorrow. And Scott, there are two players on my list that I struggled to find, you know, stuff on. And Brendan McMorrow is one of those players. I can look at his elite prospects page. I can find, you know, the sort of usual suspects rating draft picks, but after that, I'm, you know, facts about Brendan McMorrow, hard to spot. So what do we got on Brendan McMorrow?
Well, if you pull up my overage ranking at theathletic.com, you will find a full report, not to pat myself on the back here, but you will find he was a full report on him in my top 15 overagers in this draft class. Brendan was actually one of the kids who was on my list a year ago that went undrafted. So a kid that I at least had enough time for, where I ranked him in the sort of 90s, hundreds range on my list, which typically means that I would feel comfortable taking that player in the sixth or seventh round. That's how I felt about him in his first year of eligibility. Then he goes back to the USHL after 2 years at the NTDP. And instead of jumping straight into college, which I think is often a mistake for a lot of those NTDP kids who need to go and play and get more offensive opportunity and develop, I thought he made the right decision, which was to spend a year in the USHL before going off to college. And McMorrow's a really interesting kid because he's a true competitor. And whether or not he makes it, he's one of those kids that, you know, is just going to take his career as far as his game and his talent will allow it to go. Just works, gets after it, forechecks, wants to be in the battle, wants to be in the mix, keeps his feet moving. One of those guys who at the end of his shift, when he's coming to the bench, he's tired because he's working out there. Can never fault the work ethic with McMorrow. I think there's a risk that he just becomes a very good checking college player and that there isn't enough natural offense there for him to get an NHL contract. Or if he does get an NHL or an AHL contract coming out of college, that he just becomes a bottom six AHLer. But I liked the bet in the seventh round, your odds are slim. And I liked the bet on a kid who you at the very least know is going to work his tail off. And at the very least will, if he's in your development camps, he's going to be a tone setter in your development camps. And there are little things that matter like that in an organization in terms of just the tone that you want within your organization. And McMorrow is just a kid who just gets after it. And I've always appreciated that about his game.
When you look up a stats page, you know, you mentioned earlier, like, it is difficult to score in the USHL, and he had 24 goals, was like a top 20 goal scorer, top 10 in playoff goals. Like, how does he get his offense? Is he the kind of guy who kind of earns what he gets? He's not, you know, going to score the pretty highlight goals, but maybe knows where to go to get some of those greasier ones?
Yep, absolutely. He scores his goals by being in the right spots, by working to get to rebounds, by winning battles below the goal line and taking pucks to the net. that's his game. I think there's a little bit of skill there. I've seen him make little small area passes under triangles of defenders' sticks and that kind of a thing. But it all starts with going and getting pucks, winning back pucks for his line mates, and then just working the puck to the middle of the ice and figuring it out from there. And that's a very respectable way to play hockey. And I think it's going to serve him well as he tries to climb the ranks and make more of a name for himself.
All right, the ninth and final player we're going to talk about, drafted in the seventh round, 216th overall, Will Sharp. And Mark, we've talked about all the other eight players. We've talked about Dev Camp. It shouldn't be taken as a serious evaluation tool. However, I went in to Dev Camp 3 out of the 4 days that they were scrimmaging. And I confess, I didn't notice Will Sharp on the first scrimmage, but something that Zach mentioned did stick out to me. And then it matched with what I had read about Will Sharp. And so I kept an eye on him in the other scrimmages. And then I started to see it. And that was one of his strengths. He's listed as a creative passer. And Zach mentioned seeing him connect on a lot of difficult and impressive passes during the scrimmage. So, I mean, is that a decent place to start talking about Will Sharp?
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's got quick sort, quick vision. Those are the kind of things. I think he's a little quicker in his sort and vision than he is creative. Where a guy like Clark or Carlson would be more creative, you know, like multi-option, like they're looking off one way, trying to scan. This guy is a guy, he's quick. He reads, he looks at the ice, he looks at the coverage, and he sorts really quickly. So he gets the puck moving up ice quickly, which forwards really like, especially in the game now, the way it's, how fast the transition is. He moves the puck quickly. He gets the puck, you know, he reads it, executes very quickly, which creates speed and flow and pace going up the ice. So that's a great place to start with him.
Yeah, this guy strikes me as someone who has a lot of tools, positive tools, but maybe not the toolbox. I don't know if that's a fair analogy just yet, but very tough team to play on, maybe in a role that was hard to be in. Is that fair at all, like on a young player, to say like he has a lot of really good, you know, elements to him, but maybe we haven't seen him in the right position to be like as successful as he could have just yet?
Yeah, I mean, you can only blame so much on the team. And again, he wasn't in a great situation, you know, in terms of support. But that being said, I think what happens with him is you go to a game and you see one or two of his skill sets, right? And they really stand out. Like you might see like he's got for a, I don't want to say undersized, he's just about 6 feet, but he's got power in his stride. You know, like he cuts the ice up. You know, when he rushes or when he decides to turn his feet up ice, he can really move in a straight line. He can really rush the puck. He can penetrate, and you'll see that. But then, like, his defense will be terrible. Like he just, it'll just be an afterthought. And then the next game you'll see his passing really stand out and his defense will be better, but it kind of is subdued in the skating area or stuff. So a lot of the times when I saw him or when our scouts saw him, he displayed, you know, I think he's got three excellent attributes. I think his skating is an excellent attribute. I think his shot is a very good attribute. And I think his quick, you know, his quick puck movement up the ice, whether it's jumping up the ice in the rush or sorting and making a quick pass, is good. I think his defense needs to get better, both in terms of technique and buy-in. But as I said, what would happen is you would see one of these tools or one of these skills on display at a higher level when you went and watched him play, and then the others would either fade into the background or you would see some of the negatives that can come out of his game. If he could ever put them all together, that would be something. And as said, you know, they're there, and he's young and he hasn't matured yet. He hasn't matured off the ice. He needs more buy-in off the ice. I think he realizes that now. But as I said, like, you know, Payette talked to him after the draft. The kid was so excited. You know, sometimes when a kid goes late, he's down in the dumps. This this kid was excited, ready to go. And, you know, I got to improve on this. This really shows me what I got to do. And so, you know, he seemed to have the right mindset. And if he could somehow put those, if he could somehow improve the deficiencies while getting those three things to all come out at the same time, as I said, that's a big ask, but it's harder to put the things, it's harder to get ingredients that aren't there than to, you know, than to make the ingredients all work together when they're there. So
I feel like you kind of just answered what I was about to ask, but like when I talked to him at development camp, he basically evaluated himself exactly as you did. You know, he asked him like, what are your strengths? What do you need to work on? He said them exactly as you did. Like he had said, I have to get better defensively, but highlighted kind of the same strength. Is that a small step of the buy-in you're talking about? Is maybe step one is acknowledgement, and then it goes into, okay, how do you actually work on those kinds of things?
Yeah, especially since some of our early conversations, that wasn't the case. You know, as I said, being on the precipice of not getting drafted can lend you some clarity, you know, in terms of, you know, as I said, I mean, you know, on one hand, it doesn't matter if you get drafted or not. I mean, at the end of the day, except for the fact that it does, like, because you work your whole life and that's part of the goal. So, you know, in terms of achieving the NHL, it doesn't matter unless you're drafted in the first round, then it matters. But in terms of achieving the goal, it doesn't. But it's a step along the way and it's a step that you planned for. So the fact that it was almost not there for him, I think was better than if not, you know what I mean? The fact that it could have been, and as I said, the things he said at development camp were not necessarily the things he was saying in January. So if as I said, you hope it has a long-term effect on him and not just in the, you know, the immediate effect is easy. The filling that long-term effect out, because as I said, for 17 years, there's some stuff he hasn't done right. It's harder to fix that in, as I said, it's easy to fix in 1 month. But, you know, try going on a diet for 1 month and try going on a diet for a year, you know, try going to the gym every day for, there's a whole bunch of things. But if it truly resonated with them, a big step, it's an important step.
Confirmation bias is an incredibly dangerous thing. And I'm guilty of it, as guilty of it as anybody, if not more. So a few years ago, when I started thinking about the pattern that I had noticed in the type of defenseman that the LA Kings acquire, whether through the draft or free agency or trade, when I asked Rob Blake and Todd McClellan if I was onto something, and they both kind of said, yeah, you are, that probably made it worse than better, because then I was like, oh, well, then everything I think is 100% true all the time. The reason I bring it up is that the impression I got for a while was that the Kings like smaller puck moving defensemen to be on the right side and larger stay at home defensemen on the left. That seemed to be a pattern that held pretty much true. There are always players that didn't fit it. You know, Sparks being the top example that leaps to mind. Will Sharp seems to flip the bias on its head, right? He all the boxes he ticks seems to be the boxes that I would expect out of a right shot defenseman. And part of the problem was that I had assumed that that was part of the 1-3-1 and that that was an organizational focus. And it was semi-confirmed on multiple times, but never fully explained. It's a long-winded way of asking. The 1-3-1 is gone. Todd McClellan is gone. Now Rob Blake is gone. You have a new general manager, a new head coach, new systems, new preferences, all of that. Are there guiding principles when it comes to types of players, or at 216th overall, does it not really matter, or did it never matter in the first place and I just needed a myth to believe in to make everything make sense?
Matters at the NHL level. As I said, you whatever you're doing is affecting everything you do at the NHL level affects you immediately. It's so if you see a pattern in the NHL, it's probably for a reason. It's probably a methodology, a process, you know, a mission state, whatever. In the AHL, lesser, but still, you could still discern pattern. In the amateur, no. I will say this. Dean gave us his mission statement. When you're drafting, this is what I want. This is how I want to build a team. You know, this is the A is the most important attribute all the way down to C, D, E, or F, whatever you want to say. That's what I want. That's how I want to focus the draft. That being said, you know, once you get out of the first round, it's harder to find, you know, and the further you go in the draft, and even once you get out of the top 10 picks. So, and Rob had a certain, and a different thing. Rob, there were some similarities in what Rob wanted and Dean wanted, but there were far more differences in what Rob wanted and Dean wanted. So it, as an amateur scout, or as, you know, my job is to, in the amateur department, is to take what their mission statement is and make it work as best as I can in each instance. But the fact of the matter is, I couldn't always give Dean what he wanted, and I couldn't always give Rob what he wanted. And I haven't had the discussion as what I know what Ken likes. We've had some discussions, and it's pretty easy. Ken makes it very clear, but we haven't had that in-depth discussion yet. But which each one of those three GMs, you go in with an understanding of what they want, and then it blows up at a certain point. And, you know, as I said, I can get size here, but nothing else here. I can get skating here, but nothing else here. So unless you're, as I said, if you're picking high, like if you're picking Byfield, if you're picking Doughty, if you're picking in the top five, the GM has a lot of sway, because the things he wants are usually there, are usually there. The further you get, the less you can stay according to the plan. It's just, there aren't enough good players. There aren't enough players like that. As I said, there have been times when each one of the, not so much Ken, because we just had one draft. But there have been times that each of the other ones has interjected and saying, this is what I want at, in the sixth round or the fourth round or the, but it's much rarer the further you go in the draft.
All right. And final player that we're going to talk about, taken in the seventh round, 216th overall, Will Sharp. And it's not fair to invoke the names that I'm about to invoke because they were not taken this deep in the draft. But in recent drafts by the LA Kings, Ryan Conmee and Jay Reeder sort of stood out and made names for themselves. Now, Reeder was a seventh rounder. Conmee was a sixth rounder. Those are forwards. They had similar profiles to Will Sharp. They were sort of undersized but scrappy forwards who, if they were a few inches taller, maybe they would have gone way higher in the draft. But the reason I invoke those names is because at Dev Camp, I'm sorry, I'm stepping on Zach's anecdote because he was the one who noticed it and not me, but Will Sharp did stand out at Dev Camp the way that Reeder and, or Conmee at least did, because Reeder wasn't here last year, but Conmee certainly in his Dev Camp grabbed eyeballs and put himself on the map, at least within the Kings media ecosystem. Because ordinarily a seventh round draft pick, you're sort of like, oh, okay, well, maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't. Going into Dev Camp, I didn't have high expectations for Will Sharp, Scott, but now that Zach saw what Zach saw, and we've talked about it, now all of a sudden Will Sharp is on my radar.
And I think he belongs on your radar. Was one of the only players drafted in the seventh round this year who was still available on my list. Will was sort of in the 80s and 90s on my list throughout the year. A bit of a tricky player to evaluate last year. He was traded within the WHL from Lethbridge to Kelowna. Kelowna was a horrid, horrid team in the WHL last year, and he was asked to do too much. He was asked to play too much. He was asked to make plays. He was asked to be on the power play. He was asked to be on the penalty kill. He, I believe, finished the year like over minus 40, and I think he only played 30-something games.
Minus 41 in 31 games is the only thing I could have told you about him.
Yeah, so he got caved in, and there were a lot of games where he looked, and this is a part of his game that he needs to work on. This isn't just blaming Kelowna, but there were a lot of games where he just looked, and I've talked to people around him about this a little bit, and sort of my own criticisms of his game, but there were games where he looked like a chicken with his head cut off out there. Like he was just racing around trying to make things happen, and that can catch your eye, as I'm sure it did for you guys at development camp and as it did for me on some really positive moments last year. But it can also catch your eye because he's chasing it and he's trying to do too much and he's trying to create offense when he shouldn't be. And it's going back the other way for breakaways, or he's sloppy defensively or what have you. So part of it was just being asked to do too much on that Kelowna Rockets team. I'll be fascinated to see what he looks like this year, because they've been awarded the Memorial Cup. And when that happens, it's your responsibility as an organization to load up. And this Kelowna Rockets team was further away last year, a year out from hosting the Memorial Cup, than any recent team that I've covered in my dozen years doing this on a full-time basis has ever been from being ready to be a Memorial Cup team and compete with the three league champions for the biggest trophy in junior hockey. And so they have a lot of work to do, but that's going to mean that Will gets to play a lot again, and that he gets to be a part of a team that plays the final hockey of the year. And the Memorial Cup is the final hockey of the year outside of the Stanley Cup playoffs. It finishes after all of the European leagues finish. It finishes after the Frozen Four. It's sort of the finish line, and he's going to play a lot of hockey. He's going to be on the ice a lot next year. Even if Kelowna loses in the WHL playoffs, he's going to have a month of practicing to get ready for the Memorial Cup with the Rockets, and they're going to count on him again. And they're going to bring in other defensemen that are going to push him probably down the depth chart into a role that is more appropriate for him as a player at this stage in his development. But he's going to get a lot of touches, and he's going to be involved a lot, and he's going to play big minutes, and that's going to be really, really good for him, I think. The talent is there. He's actually quite a talented player. More talented than the other defenseman taken in the seventh round, for example. Now it's just about, is he just a chicken with his head cut off who doesn't know how to play hockey? Or was that a byproduct of the team that he played on and the circumstances that he was in a year ago? And it's probably somewhere in between. I think he has work to do in terms of his decision-making and his eagerness to just run around out there and make things happen. But he can also make things happen. And there aren't many seventh round picks that you can say that about in terms of defensemen who can create offense and jump into the rush and have some pro qualities to their game as well. So he's exactly the type of player that I think you should be targeting in the seventh round, a player whose talent is maybe a little outsized for that range, but who has some clear areas to work on. And I wouldn't be surprised. Now, he may just be what he is, and he just is a haywire, entertaining WHL defenseman. But I think there's a chance that he could be something maybe slightly more than that. And that I wouldn't be shocked, for example, if 2 years from now he's coming out of the WHL with an entry-level contract or an ATO to go and try to cut his teeth with the Ontario Reign or that kind of a thing. Like, I think there is enough there that that's at least a potential option for him. And that's why he was on my list.
Scott, reading what you wrote about Will Sharp and now kind of listening to what you're saying, he strikes me right now as kind of a tools without a toolbox kind of guy. Like, there are some exciting things, but maybe not like the framework yet to like put it all together. Is it almost like to see which route he takes, you have to see how he performs in like a more stable environment? Like, how does he use his tools when he actually has like a toolbox to use them in?
Yeah, no question. And he's going to get that this year. I mean, obviously they've got TJ Ginla coming back from injury. They went out and acquired Hayden Palpinekas, who was a mid-round pick in the draft to the Montreal Canadiens, and who I was told stood out at Montreal's camp. So there are some pieces there, and they're going to spend more. They're going to mortgage their future. They're going to trade away first and second and third round picks. They're going to look at everything they can do to make sure that when the Memorial Cup starts next May in Kelowna, that they're ready to compete with the big dogs in the CHL and push for a title. And frankly, those host teams win that tournament about once every 4 years. So typically they're on par with the three league champions. Typically they're one of the five or six best teams in the CHL in their year that they host. I think Kelowna's got a lot more work to do than typical to get there, but he should be, by the end of next season, after they've gone through the trade window in January and the Kelowna Rockets have added to their roster and they're down the stretch of the second half and into the WHL playoffs, they should be a very competitive team by that point. And he's going to be an important part of that team. And I think that in and of itself will be very, very important for him.
There's not a 100% hit rate on the LA Kings drafting defensemen to fit a mold over the last 8 years. But if it's not 100%, it's 85% or higher. The only deviation from the rule that I can think of off the top of my head is Jack Sparks and maybe Tobias Bjornfoot if you want to. But generally speaking, the Kings draft left shot defensemen that fit a certain style, and they have previously drafted right shot defensemen that fit a certain profile. And this is the first, you know, first draft under Ken Holland. We know that Mark Yannetti was given free reign to run the draft, but Will Sharp sounds like an LA Kings right shot defenseman, but he is in fact a left shot defenseman. Is this the start of, you know, restructuring a new set of expectations for this club? Or is this just, hey, it's the seventh round, we've already drafted eight guys, and let's draft the best player available?
I think it's more the latter. I think it's more just sort of seeing something in the player, seeing that there's more there than meets the eye and that there's room for him to get better and a path for him to get better. Now, in saying that, do Brustevich, Harrington, and Sharp all sort of fit the Kings mold in one way or another? Yes, I do think that the 3D that they took in this year's class do sort of make sense for the way that they've drafted in the past. Now, are any of those guys going to be the Brock Faber diamond in the rough? Probably not, but could you get one or two future NHL options for you out of that group of three? I think that is possible.
Last question from me, and this one is not about the Kings draft class, but just a curiosity. How would you feel about shrinking the draft by a round or two? You know, we now have 32 teams. There's possibility of more. You know, you said like teams aren't ranking 200 plus players. I saw you roll your eyes a bit there when I asked. So you're not in favor.
I wasn't rolling my eyes, but I don't see an issue with the current format. There are still enough players coming out of the seventh round, even if it's one or two players per draft class. There are still enough players coming out of the seventh round that are playing in the NHL that I think it's worthwhile to give NHL scouting departments an opportunity to prove themselves there. Now, you can do that with a shortened draft by then going out and signing those players, and it gives you a bigger, larger free agent pool, if you will. But I think 200 players, 224 players, which it typically is, occasionally 225 with compensatory picks, I think it's about the right number. I wouldn't have a super strong opinion one way or another if it were six or seven rounds. But I do have a very strong opinion about changing the draft age. I think that's nonsensical. And there's talk of, whenever people suggest that the draft should be a 19-year-old draft instead of an 18-year-old draft, I think if you've watched hockey in the last decade and the number of young players that have broken into the league and had an immediate impact, the desire to make the league older seems like a terrible idea to me.
I'd not even heard that one before.
But I wouldn't have a super strong opinion about necessarily shortening the draft. I just don't think that's top of mind for the NHL these days.
All right. Well, I won't even get into my real thinking, which is that they should get rid of the whole thing altogether. But that's a longer conversation for another day.
As the son-in-law of a Brit who's a fanatic of the world football landscape and the way that it operates, I know that in my in-law's house, there would be major, major backing from the soccer family on my wife's side for no draft whatsoever.
I'm telling you, I'm ahead of my time, Zach. All right, Scott Wheeler, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. Thanks for taking us through all nine things.